Good morning, everyone. This meeting is called to order January 21st, 2015 at 9:08 a.m. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State. It is required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. Next order of business, approval of the minutes from the previous work session held November 5th, 2014, which have been distributed. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Commissioner Jones, Commissioner Lee, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carried. The work session item number one, update on the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department progress in implementing the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department Land and Water Resource Conservation and Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith, please make your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Carter Smith. Good morning to everybody. Just as a point of departure, I want to do one thing, and that is introduce the new member of our leadership team here, Craig Bonds, our new director of Inland Fisheries. And Craig has been a fisheries biologist with us for 16 years. He's worked in all regions of the state. He is incredibly well respected inside and outside the agency. We could not have a better leader to help lead the next generation of inland fisheries in the state. I think the highest compliment that I can give Craig is he had very, very stiff competition. We had some fabulous candidates for this job, and so very, very proud to see Craig take on this leadership role. And so let's welcome him to that new role. So Craig, welcome. I thought, Mr. Chairman, I'd provide a quick update on where we stand with the land and water plan. You and the commission had approved a series of 30 benchmark measures, and you all should have a handout of that in front of you that summarizes these measures. Just as a reminder, obviously, this is by no means all-inclusive of everything we do. It is simply a snapshot of a variety of the most salient things that we're involved with, whether it's programmatic, outreach, acquisition, restoration, good business practices, et cetera. And really what I want to do is give you a quick quarterly update of where we stand with respect to these measures. And this slide right here gives you just a graphical representation of all that. We are on target for 22 of those measures, where we projected we would be in the first quarter of the year. We're ahead on two particular measures. One measure we've actually completed, that is all the baseline surveys that we committed to do from an archaeological and natural resource perspective on the Devil's River site. And then there are five in which we are behind where we had projected to be. I have visited with all of the responsible division directors who have those areas within their purview for those five. They assured me that we have good reasons for why we are behind and expect fully to be able to get those back on track. And so I don't have any concern or consternation about where we stand on those five. And if you want any more detail on that, I'm happy to elaborate.
Would you identify the
Yep,
five?
Sure will. Yep. So there are five particular measures in which we are behind where we projected to be. Looking again at your handout, item number four, completing the public use plan for the Palo Pinto Mountain State Park by the end of December. We had to pull our planner off to work on another project, and that put us behind, but we will have this plan done by the February 23rd event that we've got at the state park. So that one will get completed very soon. Number 11, adding 1 million acres under active wildlife management plans. We had projected that we would, I forget our acreage goal that we would have. We projected that we'd have 300,000 new acres planned by the end of the quarter. We're actually at 139,000, almost 140,000. Talking with Clayton and the team, and looking at historical patterns, there really isn't a good quarterly pattern to predict how that's going to fall out over the course of the year. In other words, so the 300,000 acres that we had predicted in the first quarter, if you look back in past years, some years we've exceeded that, some years we've been way below it. So I'm not sure we have this measure as well refined from a quarterly perspective, but in terms of our capacity and ability to meet that goal as the year progresses, Clayton is confident that we're going to be able to meet it. The third one that I'll bring up is item number 18. On an annual basis, 15 million fingerlings will be stocked in Texas rivers and reservoirs to provide quality fishing opportunities. We had projected at the end of the first quarter we'd stock about 250,000 fingerlings. We're at 170,000 fingerlings. I guess what I'd say, talking with Craig and the team, the third and fourth quarters are really the telltale time for this, in which we have projections to stock, 6.7 million and then another 6 million fingerlings. So the first quarter measure is not a big number, and the team has got a good explanation why we're a little behind on that front. And by the way, just I should have said this, we track all of these in a very comprehensive spreadsheet, and I'm happy to share this with y'all if you want more detail. But again, it's really the third and fourth quarters that we'll need to pay particular attention to on that one. Item number 21, collaborate with existing partners to deliver outdoor education programs to 2,500 Houston residents by the end of August. That's a state park related measure. We had projected that we would meet or that we would reach 600 people in the first quarter, and we reached 574, so we were off by a little bit. The last measure is a law enforcement one. Sponsor Operation Outdoor events statewide and attract a minimum of 30,000 participants from underrepresented communities by August 31st of 2015. We had estimated that we would reach 7,000 participants by the end of the first quarter. We're at 4,300. In talking to Craig, to be fair, our law enforcement team has simply had other higher priorities they've had to focus on. And so it's just, we've just so much resources that we have to allocate. Craig's talked to the team, and I'm sure by the end of the year we'll be able to meet this goal. But candidly, we've just had other priorities on that front. So what I'll ask the commission is, if you want more detailed information on where we stand and what our quarterly projections are with these measures and what our estimates are, let me know, and I'll provide you that detail. Obviously, every commission meeting, we're going to provide an update as to where we stand. Any questions on that? Okay, moving ahead, internal affairs update. That team led by Major Carter, John Gray, Johnny Longoria, Brad Chappell continues to do an exemplary job in all of their myriad responsibilities inside the agency. They completed 160 investigations last year. Obviously, we're early on in this fiscal year, not a whole lot to report. I will brag on John Gray, who is a newly minted graduate of the Governor's Executive Development Program, and we're excited about that. Both he and Clayton Wolf were selected to represent the agency in that prestigious leadership development program, and so I want to compliment John and Clayton, for wherever Clayton is, for their participation and success there. Proud of both of those for going through that program. I think y'all are aware that we launched the first ever joint Game Warden Park Police Academy in January, and so the academy is off to a great start. Very proud of those cadets, incredibly professional, and look forward to y'all helping us commission them in August at the end of their 7-month tenure at the academy. Internal Affairs has already been out there to train the cadets on the important role that Internal Affairs plays in law enforcement related investigations, complaints against peace officers, as well as the ethics process inside the agency. And so again, Internal Affairs will be regular participants and instructors out there as the academy proceeds. Next thing I want to present is a new web-based mobile app in law enforcement, affectionately known as Pocket Cop. This is just a fabulous technological advancement. I want to compliment Gary Teeler and Mike Mitchell with the law enforcement program. This allows our officers to be able to use an iPhone app that is only for their state phones to be able to run background checks on people, guns, property, vehicles, boats, give them instantaneous information on all of that information. It's linked to our databases so they can access citation history both on the game warden side and the state park side. Any emergency alerts that may be available for outstanding arrest warrants are also flagged for those individuals. Our folks can do this very discreetly, very, very conveniently, again, giving them real-time information, and so a fabulous application. Our law enforcement team is in the throes of training our officers how to use that. They expect to have everybody on the law enforcement side trained up by April. We've got about 125 officers that are now trained in using this in the field now. Now, this does not mean that we're not going to continue to use our dispatchers, which play a critical role in helping to run other background checks and provide important information to our officers when they call in. So it does not substitute for that. But again, in terms of discreetly and quickly getting information that they need in the field to check things, this mobile app is a huge operational advancement for us, and so really proud of the team for developing it. There's another feature on here that I would be remiss if I did not mention, and that's a safety feature. There is a GPS feature associated with this app that allows us to be able to know exactly where an officer is and time of duress. And so there is a simple call button that they can hit if they get in a situation in which they need help, and that'll send out an alert to colleagues to come. And so a really important feature for our officers out there in the field that are, as all of you know, exposed to some very vulnerable and dangerous situations. So great advancement. Real proud of the team for it. So.
Can this app be used for suspicious commissioners?
No comment, Commissioner.
I do have a serious question.
Yeah, sure.
Do all of our officers have state-issued iPhones?
All of our officers have state-issued phones, whether it's iPhones or a Verizon phone. I guess we probably have a mix there, yeah. But they certainly have state-issued phones. Most of them are iPhones.
Well, my question is, will this app work on Android units as well as iPhone?
Let me get Mike Mitchell to come up, who's been the architect behind this, and answer those questions. Mike.
So if you'll recall...
Mike, if you'll introduce yourself, sorry for the record. Sorry. I know. It's, somebody has to set the rules here, Mike. It's
Lieutenant Mike Mitchell from the Law Enforcement Division. So there's two different groups using this. In law enforcement, we are all standardized to iPhones, or 99%, and it is made only for the iPhone. In state parks, their law enforcement group, some have iPhones, some have other devices, and we're still working through moving forward on how we're going to get everyone on the same platform for that. State parks has bought 10 licenses so far, and we're just starting to roll that out to them.
So does the department pay for law enforcement phones? Not parks. I'm talking now just law enforcement.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and those are... all iPhones. Those
yes,
are,
sir.
Those are all
99%. We have five right now that aren't.
Okay, but that's my question. Why are five not on iPhones? Is it a personal choice, or do we have a department-wide mandate that look, we got to get consistent so everybody get an iPhone?
It's the latter. We're getting consistent on it. We just have a few that we just haven't renewed the contract, changed them over.
Okay. The reason I'm Joe Carter and I were in AT&T. Getting our phones updated not too long ago, about a week or two ago. And so just made me think in terms of, is that a personal phone that you have to get and then you use it for the department, or is it a department?
No, unfortunately, because of the FBI requirements, because of the amount of data that's coming from 50 states and 7 territories, we cannot allow anyone to use a personal phone.
Ah.
It's a prohibition by the FBI.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah, if you have a question.
Do you have one?
No, go ahead.
Carter, when you said that the app has access to our database, I assume you mean Parks and Wildlife.
Yes.
Does it also have access to the DPS database?
Yes, sir, it does. We have 700,000 citations from both game wardens and state parks that we access right away. But the system also looks into DPS. If somebody is wanted, it gets their driver's license, their license plate, that type of information. It does not bring their criminal history into the iPhone. Our feeling is that's a lot of information. We want that officer to make a phone call to the dispatcher at that point.
I just want to make sure it wasn't just limited to parks and wildlife.
No, it goes all the way across 50 states, 7 territories via the FBI. It's a really complicated path, but we're doing all of it.
To Bill's point, then you will be able to find Scott. I'm only jesting. I'm only jesting.
Can you talk a little bit about the backup in instances where we don't have cell coverage? I mean, presumably that's why we have the
dispatchers, dispatch, radio.
You've hit the nail on the head, and that's always a concern, especially in remote areas or out in the Gulf beyond 8 or 9 miles.
Yeah.
I wish I had a great answer. We are looking at different boosters, and there's pros and cons to those. You may have seen TV commercials. Unfortunately, they're not all there set up to be, and sometimes they're really cost prohibitive. We're also working on, we have a kind of a lead at the table of a nationwide phone network that the government is looking at building called FirstNet, and I'm real proud of Assistant Commander Gary Teeler, who actually represents all state agencies, and that's kind of a whole other discussion. Mm-hmm. But we're constantly looking at how to solve that, and I wish I had a quick answer on it. It's a frustrating point, admittedly.
Thank you.
Good question, Jim. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mike. Good work on that. He and Gary really have done a phenomenal job bringing that forward. And, you know, this commission has been very, very consistent with respect to direction to us to help look at how we modernize our communication, and we use more social media, web-based platforms to help operationalize our activities as well as communicate externally. So I'm excited about this development and a lot more ahead. So thanks for the opportunity to share their good work. Talk a little bit about reestablishment of the Guadalupe Bass to the Blanco River. This is a great project, and certainly want to provide recognition to Tim Birdsong and others inside the agency that have been working on it. You know, Guadalupe bass are our state fish, native black bass, little fighters found in these hill country streams from the Pernalis to the Llano. And one of the challenges that our fisheries biologists have dealt with in these hill country rivers is the hybridization of the Guadalupe bass with introduced smallmouth bass in those rivers. And so in the drought 2011, our biologists saw an opportunity there in the Blanco River where large stretches of the river went dry between the state park and a very prominent feature on the river called the Narrows, in which there were just a few kind of residual extant pools. They were able to go in, remove all of the smallmouth and the hybridized fish, and then come back in and stock Guadalupe bass that had been reared at the A.E. Wood hatchery there in San Marcos. And so it was a great success. And even better, we're seeing naturally occurring reproduction of those fish in 2 years. So, again, excited about that work there in that Hill Country River as well as others. Great partnership with Texas Tech and the Nature Conservancy, which have been intimately involved in this. So very, very nice public-private collaboration. A lot of excitement by communities and fishing guides, too, in these Hill Country rivers that really see Guadalupe bass as a great tourist attraction for fly fishermen and others in these communities. So good work on the inland fisheries side. Mother Neff State Park. On Friday, we're going to reopen that state park. You know, it has been, for all practical purposes, under renovation since the last big flooding event in 2008. Many of you know the history of that park, donated to the state by Governor Pat Neff in honor of his mother, hence the name Mother Neff state parks. It's right there on the Leon River, just kind of northwest of Fort Hood. Beautiful, beautiful bottomlands along the river, and also some really nice upland areas. In flooding events, when Belton Lake will flood, it'll back water all up that river channel, would flood the bottomlands where we had camping loops and a group use facility. We had a rather poor headquarters complex. And so after the latest flood in 2008, the legislature provided funding to the agency to go back in and address issues that occurred here and at places like Paladura Canyon that also had major floods, and then, of course, parks impacted from the hurricane, Sea Rim and Galveston. But terrific work done here by our infrastructure team to build a new headquarters and visitor complex, a new maintenance barn, a new camping loop, and they have built something that I think we'll all be very proud of and that absolutely will also withstand another 50 years and also give us a little room to grow. I mean, that's the real problem in many of our parks that y'all have been in. You see these little pillbox type structures that serve as the headquarters and office complexes that were built in the 70s, not very well built at all at the time because of resources, and also almost after immediately they were open, they became too small. And so they actually thought through this and thinking ahead about future use. So we're excited about the reopening of that this Friday. Anybody who can join us, we'd love to see you at the state park on Friday at 10 a.m. Discounted state park passes. This was a great partnership between state parks, communications, and the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, in which they took advantage of the holiday season to help promote getting folks outside. They essentially paid for vouchers to the state parks and then marketed those to their various audiences and basically raised about $50,000 to the state parks with this promotional event in December, and one of many, many things that the foundation is doing to help support the work of the department. And I know our state parks team in particular was very pleased with the outcome of this, and kudos to Jay Clayburgh and others with the foundation that worked very hard on this. Last but not least, a quick update on Hunter Ed. I know that's been a topic of great interest to this commission. Last year, our Hunter Ed team in communications certified a little over 67,000 students. That's another record year, 44% increase over the previous year, which is a record in that year. So the previous year, Josh, I think was around 46,000 students that were certified. This past year, 67,490. You'll be interested to know that 47% of those students completed their Hunter Ed through the online only option. So we're seeing a lot of folks use that who are eligible, and so we're proud of making that available and accessible to folks. So we'll continue to monitor that and report to the commission on that, and we'll obviously also be looking at safety-related considerations and see if any issues pop up there. We're not expecting them to, but we certainly know that's been an issue to the commission. But excited about these record numbers of hunters being certified on the Hunter Ed. With that, Mr. Chairman, Commission, that completes my presentation, and happy to address any other questions that you or the commissioners may have.
Any questions? Thank you, Carter.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before we move ahead, I'd like to announce that agenda item number 8, land sale, Brown County, will be pulled from today's agenda. Work session item number 2, financial overview, Mike Jensen.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Mike Jensen. I'm Administrative Resources Division Director. I have a brief presentation to walk you through the first quarter budget for the department and the three primary revenue streams. If we look at this first slide, this gives you a summary through November 30th for the state park revenues that have come in. The facilities revenue, you can see, is 6.4% ahead of last year. Entrance fees, 11.8% ahead. Concessions, 14.9% ahead, park passes 4.7% ahead, and miscellaneous fees 2.2% ahead. So we're 8.5%, about $831,000 ahead of last year. I reminded y'all at the annual meeting that 13 was a good year, and 14 was a very good year. So I think the comptroller has noticed that. The standard that has been set in our BRE now, they expect us to hit about $45 million a year in revenue. Chairman Hughes, when you started here, when I started here in 2009, State Parks revenue was closer to about 38 a year, 39. So the department's doing very well there. Or we're also doing well with visitation. Paid visits are up compared to last year by nearly 10%. And year-to-date total visits are up nearly 12%. So the Parks Group is doing a great job. And if you look at this year, month-to-month, September was 3% ahead, October was nearly 15% ahead, and November was 8% ahead. With respect to boat revenue, you can see here we're slightly ahead of where we were last year, 0.5% or $15,400. You can see sales tax are up by nearly 7%. Titles are up by almost 2%. Registrations are tracking behind, but that's a seasonal and cyclical issue there. As far as the counts, new registrations and titles issued are ahead of last year, but registration transfers are behind. What you don't see on this slide, this department collects sales tax. This slide only shows what's retained by the department. We retain about 5%. What we collected for the state as a whole in 14 was $9.26 million, and this year we collected almost $9.9 million. Again, this slide only shows what we retain for the department, that 5%. So the agency has been doing a pretty good job with that respect. I think law enforcement's been pushing that issue as well. License revenue comparison, we'll just walk through the slide. Overall, you can see that there's been a shift this year from resident hunting licenses to combo licenses. If you combine the fishing resident and non-resident, we're ahead about 95,000 or 2.8%. Hunting, if you combine the resident and non-resident, we're ahead by about 1%, 42,000. The combos are up by 1.2 million, which is almost 3.9%. It's pretty significant. The fishing counts, we've sold 1,923,000 licenses this year compared to 1,884,000 licenses last year. As far as the adjusted budget, the last time we presented a budget was at the annual meeting that you approved. This represents the first quarter. Most of these adjustments all reflect unexpended balance forward from the prior fiscal year. You can see we start with $371.35 million, which was approved by the commission, which at that time included some estimates and some fringe. The first item there is federal grants and UB of $23.45 million. That comes from about 22 different sources. The top eight account for 87%. With wildlife restoration being the majority of about 45%, $10.6 million. There's additional funding from National Recreation Trail Grant there, $1.8 million, Outdoor Recreation, $1.6 million, Port Security Grant, $1.5 million, Sport Fish Restoration, $1.3 million, Joint JEA is $1.2 million, SWIG, State Wildlife Grants, what we call it, is $1.2 million, Public Assistance Grants, $1.1 million. The second line there, other appropriated receipts and contracts with UB. That's a combination of about 19 different sources. The top five make up 96% of that $15.35 million, with artificial reef being $8.8 million, which is 57%. We have Fund 64 donations that make up $1.9 million, Fund 9 donations, $1.6 million, Fund 9 reimbursements, $1.7 million, and the shrimp buyback, $656,000. The third line you see on there is Rider 31, and that allows us to UV within the biennium from the first year to the second year. $3.1 million is capital non-construction, 27%, and the remaining 73% is operational funds that are moved from 2014 to 2015 of $8.3 million. The fourth line that you see on there is the supplemental appropriation bill we had during the last session, and all of that represents capital construction projects. We have, out of that amount, we have bonds at $42.8 million, federal funds of $8.2 million, appropriated receipts are $2.6 million, and Fund 9 is $1.9 million, and Fund 64 is $958,000. The fifth line item on there, it shows a net increase of $4.88 million. During the last approval process, the commission approved $51.53 million, but we had actually $4.8 that was actually realized that we're moving into the budget. And the last three items on there, the statewide cost allocation plan. Every state agency provides funding to the oversight to run the oversight departments. That's $969,000. Employee fringe benefits, that's $430,000. In that last line item, it's negative because that's the DPS chauffeur's account that the cash is not available. $825,000. So the subtotal is $63.27 million, and the adjusted budget as of the end of the first quarter is $434.62 million. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about the first quarter, if you have any.
Any questions for Mike?
What's the status of the effort to be reimbursed for the additional border security costs that we've been forced to incur as a part of the border security ramp up?
So the costs that we incurred up until, I guess, really the 1st of November, we will look at trying to get addressed through the supplemental appropriations bill this session. Legislative Budget Board, is committed to providing the funding that we requested really from November 1st or for December 1st, onward. So we're taking care of at this juncture, the funding in the past that we had to expend again. That'll be something we hope to get addressed in the supplemental bill this session.
So expenditures prior to December 1, we're hoping to get remedied in the current
Certainly, if possible, and I'd say certainly focused on those expenditures, particularly in this fiscal year.
You'll see an adjustment next time we meet in March, because this only goes through November. There was about a $3.7 million adjustment that took place in December that was committed to by state oversight, and it's going to increase our budget. It did increase our budget in December for law enforcement.
That's why I was asking. Yes. I didn't see any adjustment for it.
This is only through November.
Only through November.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Work session item number 3, internal audit update. Cindy Hancock, please make your presentation.
Before Cindy starts, I wanted to ask for one correction in the minutes. This is very picky, but since it was a comment attributed to me, I want to change the word pervading to predating, which is what I said on page 25 when we were talking about alligator gar. So I make a motion that the minute be adjusted. So adjusted.
Absolutely.
I'll second.
What do those words mean?
Yes, can you explain what that is, please?
I don't know either one of them. I still don't know what the hell you were saying.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Cindy Hancock, Director of Internal Audit. And I'm here today to update you on the completion status of the fiscal year 14 and 15 audit plan and any ongoing or completed external audits. This is a summary of the internal audit projects approved for fiscal year 14. The check marks indicate that we have issued final reports or completed field work for all audit projects except for the data integrity audit, with field work to begin next week. Since my last update to the Commission in November, we've completed field work for 4 projects. We're in the process of obtaining management responses for the biz audit. The payment card audit report is ready to be submitted to management for responses, and the federal grant and infrastructure audit are going through their quality assurance reviews. For fiscal year 15, internal audit plan, the check marks indicate that we've begun the following projects: audit of the state-owned housing charges, audit of the travel advance account, and a follow-up of internal and external audit recommendations. The follow-up audit is in its fieldwork stage and will continue to be in fieldwork stage through August of this year. Since last September, management's implemented 13 internal audit recommendations, with 16 still in progress, and management has also implemented 2 external audit recommendations, with 22 still in progress. Currently, we have several external audits being conducted, as always. Ernst & Young's was hired by the Texas Department of Emergency Management to perform a statewide compliance audit looking at the documentation process for Hurricane Ike expenditures. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is working with our land conservation team to reconcile records regarding lands purchased with federal funds.
Wait, say that again, please.
They're doing a reconciliation of lands purchased with federal funds.
Was there some issue that led to that, or is it just a routine?
They've been working on it for several years, and the lady that was doing it, that was performing it, retired. I believe she retired, and somebody else took over, so it's been delayed. It's been ongoing for several years. I think they're down to one tract of land.
Is that normal?
The audit is certainly normal. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the specific item. Cindy, maybe we could get that information and get it to the commissioners. I'm sorry, I can't speak to it.
Sure.
Okay.
How about a little more color on the ENY project for Hurricane Ike documentation? Is that focused on state reimbursements?
Yes, it is, and it's of several agencies several agencies that they're looking at, and they're trying to determine if there's a more efficient way for agencies to retain documentation and improve the accuracy of that information.
Okay, so there wasn't an issue that they were brought in to pay particular attention to. It was just an overall efficiency review. All right.
Yes. Okay. The Department of Interior Civil Rights Division has conducted a desk review, and the department is working on delivery of missing information and completion of required actions. Our responses are due in early February this year. The Department of Interior Office of Inspector General is conducting a federal grant audit of our Dingell Johnson and Pittman Robertson funds. And finally, as of yesterday, we just had an entrance conference with the Texas Workforce Commission Civil Rights Division, who will be conducting an audit of our personnel policies and procedures. This is an audit required by Texas Labor Code to be conducted every 6 years for all state agencies. And I'll keep you posted on the outcomes of these audits as they are completed.
Cindy, before you move out, to follow up on Jim's point, on these first two external audits, is there anything that led to those, or are they just routine?
They're routine. They're routine. They were scheduled, and this was our lucky year. That concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Cindy, can you comment on the... I know we've sent the notice out to all of the commissioners over the holidays, but the DPS external peer review audit and the results of that, you know, we always talk about what's upcoming and routine or others that might be generated by other reasons, but I just would like to occasionally talk about the results of some of these audits, particularly when they're good.
That's good. Yes, we're required every 3 to 5 years, 3 years, to have a peer review done on our audit teams. The auditors audit the auditors. And we had a peer review team from the Department of Public Safety and TDI. And they came in and looked at several of our audits and interviewed several commissioners and many staff, and concluded that we pass and that our audit work meets the audit standards. So I'm very proud to have that off my plate.
I understand. And with flying colors, that was a very good result.
So. Well, thank you.
Commissioner, if I could, and I'm going where you went, they were very complimentary of Cindy and her team in the exit interview. They could not say enough good things about the quality and substance. They have appreciated the heightened engagement of the commission on the audit functions, and that was well received by the external auditors and duly noted. But again, you know, Cindy used the words meets and adequate, which are, you know, sort of typical words by an auditor, but they used that's as good as it gets for an auditor. Exactly. That's the gold standard. Absolutely.
Yeah, well said. It's also important as we go into a legislative session to make sure that what funds we are given, we have others who are suggesting that we're handling our funds appropriately and that we're not wasting state resources and that we have checks and balances. And whenever we find something that's not up to standards, we fix it. And we have an ongoing process by which we keep up with what we're doing and it continuously improves. So those kinds of things are real important right now when we go to ask for more state resources.
One thing I would like to mention is we have been without an IT auditor for several years now, and we have promoted one of our auditors and now has become certified as a certified information system auditor, Kim Teal. And now we have a qualified and very good IT auditor on our staff. So.
Very good.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Moving forward, work session item number 4, 2015-16 Statewide Hunting Proclamation. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Jason Harden and Kevin Davis, please make your presentation.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Jason Harden, Upland Game Bird Specialist with Texas Parks and Wildlife. Joining me is Assistant Commander Kevin Davis with Law Enforcement. We're here today to present proposed changes to the statewide hunting proclamation. These proposed changes are recommended by TPWD's Resident Game Bird Technical Committee and have been reviewed by TPWD's Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee. Texas offers two fall turkey zones for Rio Grande wild turkey hunting. The fall season runs concurrently with the white-tailed deer season. However, as you can see from the calendar, the late youth season in the north zone is only offered the third weekend in January. Staff proposes extending the current youth-only season to run concurrently with the youth-only white-tailed deer season, providing a total of 14 consecutive days of youth hunting opportunity following the close of the general fall season. TPWD estimates a population of 88,000 wild turkey hunters in Texas, 10,000 of whom are youth turkey hunters under the age of 18. Texas offers four spring turkey zones, three Rio Grande wild turkey zones, and an eastern wild turkey zone. In total, spring turkey hunting is available in 191 counties statewide. Staff proposes closing 11 eastern wild turkey counties shown here in the green and white striped areas. These 11 counties meet TPWD's decision variable for county closure, which states that an eastern wild turkey county will be proposed for county closure if the three-year average harvest reported at TPWD's mandatory eastern wild turkey check stations is equal to or less than one bird per season and the biologist within those districts consider the county unsuited to provide adequate harvest potential. Staff also proposes modifying Warden and Matagorda counties, shown here along the Texas coast in the orange and black striped areas, to conform with the adjacent Special 1 gobbler-only Rio Grande wild turkey zone located to the north and west. Staff believe the birds in these two coastal counties, as well as the habitat and climate, to be more representative of the Special 1 gobbler-only Rio Grande wild turkey zone than the eastern wild turkey zone. This will maintain a one gobbler-only 30-day spring-only season, but it will remove the mandatory harvest reporting requirements and alter the opening date from April 15th to April 1st. In addition to closing Angelina County, one of the 11 counties currently proposed for county closure, and in coordination with the U.S. Forest Service, staff proposes closing those Angelina National Forest Service lands falling within Jasper County. No harvest has been reported on the Angelina National Forest in recent years. Closing the Angelina National Forest will support forthcoming turkey research and an associated superstocking scheduled to take place in 2016 on this specific site.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Before we leave,
yes, sir.
Turkey, can we? I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Jason, why do we have if I'm reading this right, why do we have a different north zone for the fall and the spring? Why not just have one north zone and the same for the south? I mean, why have a different south zone, you know, whether it's fall or spring?
Yes, sir. I believe a part of that for the fall season is falling in line with the white-tailed deer season. And for the spring zone, we try to address some of our the biological nesting season and when those birds historically would initiate nesting activity. So that's the alteration on that, I believe. And again,
how long have we had that?
Since before my tenure, I've been with the department 8 years, and I believe it's been well before that, close to a decade at least.
Seems to me like that's more complicated than it needs to be to have two different north and south. I have really have four zones to
yes, sir.
Time of year. We're always talking about simplification. I would encourage us to look at that, whether we might be able to just come up with a north and a south.
I'd be glad to work with our technical committee and look into that.
I'd like to suggest we look into it.
Absolutely.
I've got a question.
Yep.
Going back to page 13, you're closing the season for Eastern Turkey in 13 counties, including Matagorda and Wharton, and then you're implementing a limited season for Rio Grande turkeys in Matagorda and Wharton. Are there no Eastern turkeys in those two counties?
We don't have genetic data from there, but all the birds in that vicinity are dominated by Rio Grande wild turkeys. So we feel that the location in the state, which has implications from historic research showing earlier nesting activity in that part of the state, as we move farther north, that nest initiation period tends to go up on the calendar. So that would impact one reason why we want to be in that zone. But also, we believe that the birds in that area to be more representative of the Rio Grande wild turkey. We didn't have a history of stocking easters in that county, but we know that there are Rios in there as well.
So there's not going to be an issue of a mistake or a misidentification?
No, sir.
Is that for the spring season?
Yes, sir. There's only a spring season. That's a special one gobbler only, 30-day spring-only season.
Season for Rio Grande turkey.
It'll be almost the exact same regulations. Spring-only season, one gobbler bag limit that is in those two counties now. Okay. Again, the season date is the primary change, and the mandatory reporting requirements go away.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Sir.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Kevin Davis with the Law Enforcement Division. Staff is also proposing a clarification to the archery-only mule deer regulations. This clarification is simply a wording change to make it clear which counties do and do not need a permit for the take of does during archery-only season. That is that's the only thing LE is proposing at this time. Any questions?
I have a question again on this zone. We're proposing to add zone nomenclature for deer.
Yes, sir. So I can speak to that some. There are some non-substantive changes in the statewide proposal that create zones for deer, javeline, and turkey. Those zones do not change the reg as it's currently written at all. It does not change season dates or bag limits. All it does is bring the clarification in line with how we have it posed to the public in our outdoor annual and in our outdoor web application. So we already state in our outdoor annual on the first page what the seasons are by zones. But it's confusing when someone goes and looks at the outdoor app, which is very popular right now, and it says North Texas right under the caption for Llano County, where the person knows he's not in North Texas. He doesn't understand why it's saying North Texas. And that's the zone language is creating a mechanism for everybody to be on the same page.
Was that run by the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee?
Can I butt in for a minute? For the record, I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. To clarify, it didn't actually change the zones. All they're doing is the way that the rules were structured, there was a list of counties where the regulations were a certain way, and then there was another list of counties where the regulations were a certain way. However, and if you looked at the counties, you could see that these counties were more north and these counties were more south. However, we never actually used the words in the regulations north zone or south zone. So these don't really change anything other than adding the words north zone and south zone. Does that make sense?
The seasons and the bag limits for the counties in the proposed zones identical?
Yes, the seasons are. Yes, sir. The season dates are.
And if I could just clarify, these are really not proposed new zones by at all. All we're doing is identifying, labeling the areas that were listed. In other words, we're saying, okay, these regulations, so the regulations, and you can kind of see that in your book. The zones are all, I mean, the counties have just been listed. So, I mean, I just want to emphasize it's not new zones.
Okay, well, I come back to my question. Was this discussed in the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee?
I don't know. I doubt it was because it's not a substantive change.
Do you know when their next meeting? Does anyone know when?
I don't think that's been scheduled yet, Mr. Vice Chairman, but it will be soon. Those members have been appointed. They've received their letters from the chairman, and I believe that Mitch and Clayton are going to be looking at setting up a meeting post-haste with that committee.
I would like to suggest this be put on the agenda for their feedback, good, bad, or indifferent.
Sure.
The committee's feedback.
Yes, we will do that.
With that concludes the presentation from staff. We're seeking permission to publish these proposed changes to the statewide.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Ralph, are you referring just to the mule deer regulations?
No, the white-tailed deer.
Oh, the white-tailed deer, but not the turkey or the mule deer.
Just the white-tailed deer.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. Thank you. Work session item number 5, 2015-16, statewide recreational and commercial fishing proclamation, request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Ken and Jeremy, please make your presentation.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski, Inland Fisheries Division, and I'm here today to go over the freshwater proposed changes to the statewide recreational and commercial fishing proclamation. I might note that these changes closely track what we previewed to you in November, and these proposed changes were presented last week to our Freshwater Fisheries Advisory Committee, and they supported all the changes as we will go over with you today. The first couple changes to three water bodies are changes that we had a special regulation and are simplifying them going back to a statewide regulation. And the first two of those are on Bronig and Calaveras reservoirs. They're cooling reservoirs, have unique environments with the heated water, high chloride content, abundant tilapia populations. We've taken advantage of some of those conditions there to stock red drum, which do well in those reservoirs. You'll notice largemouth basses in a prominent portion of that fisheries. The population there, we have been managing it with an 18-inch minimum length limit since 1995. We did see some with the abundant prey base and heated water. We did see some good growth in the largemouth bass, and we had hoped to manage that as a trophy fisheries. We did encounter some problems in that bass population in the 90s, a competition with tilapia, just the heated water, a variety of habitat issues. We implemented some stocking and habitat improvement, but since that sign, we've collected few bass over 18 inches or in our either caught or sampled, and the bass abundance hasn't responded. Because of that lack of quality in the bass population, we are proposing to move that length limit for bass back to the 14-inch minimum length limit with five fish Bailey bag, which are the statewide regulations. The activities that we undertook there were ineffective to improve that population. We've discussed this with some of the local bass clubs in and around the San Antonio area. They approve of these changes because they've, as fishing that lake over the years, they've recognized the limitations in the current bass population there. another change back to statewide on OHIV reservoir. We initially stocked that with smallmouth bass, hoping to develop a quality population out there. We put an 18-inch minimum length limit on there. Very few smallmouth are caught by anglers. We don't capture any of our samplers. The smallmouth just haven't developed much of a population out there. So we're proposing to change that back once again to the statewide limits, 14 inches and 5 fish. On Lake Nasworthy, near San Angelo, it's a kind of a rarity for West Texas, a constant level reservoir. It has abundant habitat, and it has good bank and shoreline access. Fisheries comprised of bass, crappie, and catfish, and the bass are currently under a 14-inch, under the statewide limit, 14 inches, 5 fish. That relatively stable water level has resulted in stable and consistent recruitment in the bass population, but what we've seen over the years, that growth and the size structure are unsatisfactory. The fish aren't growing all that well, and they're not to the condition level that we'd like to see. What we're proposing to do there is implement a 14 to 18-inch slot length limit for the bass. We're hoping to increase the harvest of the overabundant fish under 18 inches, get a little turnover in that population, hopefully improve the size structure and growth rate, and allow the anglers some harvest of small bass. The information we've received from local anglers are supportive of this change and are supportive of trying to harvest some of those smaller fish to improve the population. Taking a look at the alligator gar in Texas, as you know, we implemented a one fish daily bag limit in 2009. That was due to concerns about the range reduction overall in the U.S. Texas was one of the last strongholds of alligator gar, and we had some unique trophy fisheries centered on the Trinity River there in East Texas, where it was receiving a lot of notoriety as a place to go to catch a large trophy gar. After that regulation was implemented, we've undertaken to study numerous populations around the state. We've continued to look at the Trinity River. We've investigated populations in Choke Canyon and the Brazos River. Since that time, over the last few years at Falcon Lake, we've received reports of wounds on bass and a very abundant alligator gar population. Over time, as coinciding with the water level going down there, angler concerns had escalated, and this has received some legislative interest. Randy Myers, who is here in November, and his crew instituted a survey of the alligator gar populations and anglers in 2004 to take a look at that population. Just to briefly go over that, some of that information that Randy and his crew collected. As you know, Falcon is a unique reservoir. It has a unique location. It's a very remote reservoir, not close to many large population centers. It fluctuates quite a bit. It's currently 27 feet low at about 31% capacity. It has always been a very productive reservoir, produced an excellent bass fishing. When the water levels are up there, frequently it gets listed as one of the top bass lakes in the U.S. On the Mexican side, we know there's some commercial gillnet fishery. They're mostly targeting tilapia, and based on the information we have, there's minimal harvest of alligator gar. Our survey had a couple components. We looked at the anglers, tried to determine the characteristics, where they're coming from, what they like to fish for, what are their harvest, what the harvest, especially focusing on alligator gar, and how they feel about the management of alligator gar in their reservoir. We did an extensive study of the alligator gar population itself. We collected the life history data and various types to determine the impact of harvest and any potential changes of harvest on that population. The alligator gar anglers, most of those were locally based. Unlike the bass anglers, we have probably about 50-50 on anglers fishing for other things coming from other parts of the state. It was a consumptive fishery. Actually, bow anglers are harvesting all those fish, and 77% of the rod and reel anglers were keeping gar out of that when they harvested them. Looking at the harvest over the study period and previously, it's judged to be at the low level. Population harvest was probably around 1%. Most of the anglers, when asked, did express a desire for more harvest. There was some indication that they like to harvest some large trophy fish, but there was a good segment of the population that were interested in harvesting a few more fish. We took a look at the diet of the gar in the reservoir. As we found in many other situations where we looked at this, the gar, they're an opportunistic predator, top predator, and their diet primarily focuses on whatever the abundant prey fish are in that particular system. In this case, it's common carp and tilapia. Naturally, we would anticipate they would prey on some largemouth bass, 8% here, and other studies we've done, for instance, at Rayburn, it was around 4%, and others even less than that. So if you remember from Randy's presentation in November, there was one outlier, Lake Guerrero in Mexico, a food habit study done there. They found 50% of the diet was composed by largemouth bass, but we haven't seen anything like that in Texas, and I would note that Lake Guerrero has been known for years as a excellent bass lake and continues to be a good bass lake in the face of competition with the gar population there. We also collected information on the growth of the population, and what we see in Falcon is that the gar there are growing excellent growth there. We've got some of the fastest growth we've seen documented. They're maturing at a fairly young age, and this gives a good indication that we have a healthy population in that reservoir. Very importantly, we looked at the population age structure. This is a primary concern when looking at the reproduction in the system. We see that recently we've had strong year classes tied to some of those water level increases, and we've had at least some reproduction in 8 of the last 10 years. This is in contrast to what we saw in the Trinity River, where we saw fewer successful reproduction and spawning of the Algar gar over time. And I might note, as we've mentioned before, that alligator gar being a long-lived large species, we don't expect those fish to spawn every year. Their life history isn't such that they need to spawn every year, but we do like to see, that they have been having successful spawns over the recent time to continue to strength of that population. We looked at we used all this life history data in a fishery simulation model to determine the impact of a possible higher harvest rates on the population. On the bottom horizontal axis, we have the harvest rate, and on the vertical axis is an index of overfishing. We're looking to keep that below 0.35, and after that, we would the population could be considered being over-harvested, and that would cause a decline in the population. The current harvest rate is 1%, which would equate to probably about a 0.8, 0.9 on the overfishing index. And even if we bag limit to the harvest rate isn't necessarily one-to-one with one bag to 1% harvest, but even if we moved up as we proposed earlier to 5, we'd still probably be somewhere around 0.2 on the overfishing innings, which gives us a sufficient buffer before we have any concerns about reaching an overfishing situation in that population. Sum up some of the things we've looked at on the population. We do have a very unique population there in Falcon Lake. It's less vulnerable to over-harvest due to a number of factors, such as that fast growth. We have abundant spawning population. They're maturing at an early age, and we have more frequent strong year classes. So we feel that we have a population there that is a good, stable population and could withstand some additional harvest. A harvest rate is low at this time, but the anglers have expressed a desire to be able to take a few more fish out of that system. We did see that gar preyed on bass, at levels comparable to what we've seen in other Texas reservoirs. And just like on Lake Guerrero, Falcon Lake, Sam Rayburn, and other reservoirs, we've had a number of instances in Texas where we have abundant gar populations with excellent bass fishing. So those two things aren't mutually exclusive, as we've seen over time in Texas. So in summary, our proposal is to increase the bag limit from 1 to 5 fish per day. We feel, looking at the life history data and our simulation models, there's minimal risk to the population. That's really our primary concern here when we're making any changes, is to protect those gar populations. And this would also go in and support the local anglers' desire for a bag limit increase. Additionally, one thing we need to add here is a reservoir definition for Falcon Lake to establish an upper limit for enforcement purposes for the 5 fish to 1 fish bag, and we'll set that at the upstream of the reservoir at the Zapata Webb County line. That are all the freshwater changes that we are proposing at this time, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Any questions?
I've got one, just clarification. When you're looking at your overfishing index, is that just based on pounds harvested, or do you take into account that these are trophy fish that are being harvested? What I'm interested in is, what's the impact of going from 1 to 5 day a day harvest of trophy gar on the population in Falcon Lake?
Well, that index that takes account all those parameters of over-harvest, harvest of adult fish, the growth of the fish, reproductive success. So that is factored in there. We did do, Brandy presented a separate thing on looking at just the harvest of the trophy fish, and we would be at a little higher level, and we see the same thing, that we have a pretty substantial buffer there between the current harvest and to where we'd run into an overfishing population, even just segregating out those trophy fish.
Okay, I guess I'm following that, because to me, overfishing is just the poundage you take out. Versus,
well, that's one factor. It's also, if you're over-harvesting a certain segment of your larger spawning fish and you reduce that number, even though there might be poundage in smaller numbers, it's not straight poundage. It's more of where those fish are in their reproductive potential in the population. So,
but in this case, people are just targeting the trophy.
Well, that's not necessarily, there is some interest in trophy, but there are a lot of people who are the more consumptive oriented. They're not necessarily targeting trophy fish. They're just trying to catch a gar of any size. And in many cases, it's easier to catch some of those smaller fish that are more abundant in the population, and they're happy to harvest those also.
And we're going to monitor this to make sure that we're not into the over harvesting of trophy gar.
Yes.
I suppose you have that.
Yes,
our staff
typically, when any really, that's part of any regulation change. We have ongoing efforts to look at to see if that regulation change is having the effect, reaching a goal. It's just like early in the presentation, we had some instances where we put some regulations on, they weren't achieving their goals, so we moved them back. But,
well, I'm going to go along, but reluctantly, because I still think jumping from 1 to 5 when you've got such a unique resource, where primarily target of bow hunters who are going to harvest the biggest, oldest fish, seems like that's a big jump, but look forward to your report back on on the impact. Thank you.
I want to follow up on Reed's comments and go back to our November 5 discussion about this, where Reed shared the concern that a jump from 1 to 5 was aggressive. And Randy said we will monitor it and let you know the
And he said the difference between 3 and 5 was more of a social issue than a biological issue. So I think it's on that assurance from Ken, from your group, that I too reluctantly go along with it. But I think, again, this follow-up is going to be critical. I'd like to make sure we get some feedback on a later this year in a meeting about it. And I also have some questions about some of the changes in the book, starting at page 32. It looks like there's page after page of what appear to be changes. And I can't tell whether numbers actually changed or not. But in my book, starting at page 32, with amberjack, then bass, it's all highlighted in...
Right, that's just a formatting change. All that information was previous. If you go back to some of the previous proclamations, it was in a sort of a table format, and that was a little onerous to handle when we did the register submission, so we've just put it in sort of a text version.
So there are no substantive changes to any of those numbers?
No, the only changes that we did make were for some of the minor changes that we made as part of our proclamation at those changes.
Okay, then on page 34, where we talk about alligator gar and focus on May in Texoma, in that area where we know it's a prime spawning habitat,
right,
if the water conditions are right. I think I would like to suggest this is, again, some wordsmithing, but instead of saying shall take, I think the concept here was to keep people from seeking to take them or from fishing for them at all. It was to stay out of that spawning area, period. At least that's the way I intended it and thought that's what we were doing. So I'd like to suggest, instead of saying shall, insert may fish for, comma, seek to take, or take. And make that, also add that over on page. There's another spot where it appears. Page 50. Not sure why it appears there again, but it does. And then I had one other question. On page 49, under Black Drum, under statewide daily bag limits for commercial fishing, do we really have, I know you're not doing saltwater, but do we really have no bag limit at all?
Yeah, that would be based on that, I would interpret that as there would not be any.
Okay, well, whoever's going to present on that,
right,
I'd like to discuss
that
at the appropriate time.
Any more questions? You know, Ken, a lot of the concern the commission on raising the gar limit from 1 to 5, seems to me it might be appropriate to sunset this. So it's brought back to the commission in, say, 5 years, because we're not going to be here. Well, some of it may, but probably not going to still be on the commission. I know the staff will do a great job of monitoring it, but I'd like to make sure personally that it does come back to the commission. And, you know, we've been talking about gar for ever since I've been on the commission. Have it looked at one more time, and I'm just throwing that out we're all a little concerned about increasing the limit so much.
I think that's a good idea.
Sure, that'd be, you know, we'll be monitoring we'll be doing that activity anyway, and that would be fine.
Can we change the
proposal
to have a sunset in a 5 year from implementation?
Ambrot, General Counsel, yes.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you.
I like it.
Very like our brevity, do you?
Very efficient use of our time.
May I make the move? May I move to amend it?
Yes.
Sunset?
Yes.
Great idea, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay.
But before Ken goes, if we could, Ken, it's his turn in the barrel to lead the public hearing process by which we've got to go out and get feedback on these proposals, of which, you know, y'all will obviously take action in March. We've got some fairly substantive changes to that process that we think are for the better. And, Mr. Chairman, if I could, may I ask Ken just to share with you a quick summary of that?
Yep.
Right. Thank you. Ken.
Thank you. Thank you, Carter. As you know, we typically, after you approve these changes and we send them to the register, we open it for public comment, and that usually involves scheduling a number of public hearings around the state. And we've seen over time at those public hearings, unless there's a hot issue, nobody shows up anymore. We get the bulk of our comments over the internet, and we're spending a lot of staff time to go to a lot of places and just not getting any valuable public input from that. So we're kind of looking to try a little different model, sort of still have a couple of public hearings where we know we have some significant public interest. We'd have one in Lufkin to talk about the Eastern Turkey changes, and we'd also have one down in Zapata to let people to comment on the Falcon changes. But other than that, those would be the only actual public hearings we would have. We're going to implement a couple other opportunities for people to give us public input. So after this meeting, we're going to post narrated versions of our presentations on our website, on the public comment page, where we always typically allow people to comment, to sort of enhance that a little bit. And then also we're proposing in March to have some live webinars where we would do the similar, kind of go over our presentations individually by hunting and fishing and allow people to comment sort of in real time at that time to see, you know, how the public looks at that. And their input is very valuable to us, but if they don't show up, we have a hard time getting their input on that. So that's what we're proposing to do for this year. So if you have any comments or suggestions relative to that,
any comments? I talked with Carter and staff quite a bit about this, and these public meetings are getting less and less attendance. Sometimes a lot of them zero attendance, and with communications now and internet and everything that we have, it just seemed like a more efficient use of time. They've assured me if we have hot topics, we're still going to have public meetings. So I think personally it's a better use of our staff time and probably get more good feedback information than we're getting at the public meetings. Yeah, I would ask you that when you have the March webinar, let the commission know. Some of them want to listen in, see what topics are brought up. Is this going to be just a general, anybody can come on and ask a question? Or
right.
Okay, I'd like, if I'm available, I'd like to listen in on part of that.
Yeah, we'll be putting news releases out on this when the public hearings and when those webinars and that will be scheduled. So this has been all the resource divisions and law enforcement, and we worked with Josh Havens and the communications staff to try and think this over and come up with something different to, still give people an opportunity to comment and get that input that we need on these changes. So we're hoping this will be a good step in that direction.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. For the record, my name is Jeremy Leitz with the Coastal Fisheries Division. I'm here to talk today about our 2015-2016 statewide regulatory items. Really, all we have before you today is clarifications to a couple of existing rules related to crab and finfish. Right now, each of those fisheries has a rule that states basically that no more than one set of commercial fishermen display plates may be on board that vessel at any one time. However, it can be interpreted to allow for more than one license to be fished as long as the one display plate is visible at a time. And so what we're proposing to do to kind of clear that up, as that was not the intent, was to add some language. It says that only one set of commercial fishing licenses, be it the crab or the finfish, be on board when the vessel is engaged in that activity for which the license is required. And also when the plate is required to be aboard the vessel, that plate number must match the license that they're fishing as well. And that'll hopefully get rid of some of the fishing that's going on where they're using multiple licenses as long as there's one display plate being shown. That's all we got right now.
Any questions? Thank you.
Yeah.
If there's no further discussion, I'll authorize staff to publish proposed rules in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Work session item number 6, commercial shrimping regulation. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. For the record, my name is Lance Robinson with Coastal Fisheries Division, and I'm here today to request permission to publish two proposed changes in the Texas Register that deal with commercial shrimping. As you may recall, during our November meeting, I shared some information about some of the history of the license management program that's been implemented in that fishery. It was Senate Bill 750, implemented in mid-90s, put a cap on licenses and created a voluntary buyback program. Over the course of the last 18, 19 years, the number of licenses in that fishery have been reduced by about 75%. That's both bay and bait licenses, either through natural attrition or through the license buyback program. Correspondingly, we have seen a reduction in landings of shrimp in the bay. And I want to point out that the landings drop, although it can be tied back to the reduction in number of licenses, there are other factors that can affect that effort and effort reduction. During the month of December, we held a total of 7 scoping meetings with commercial shrimping interests up and down the Texas coast, had about 125 participants total at those meetings. During those meetings, we received a lot of recommendations, options brought forth by the industry. It covered the gamut, various options dealing with both seasons, spring and fall seasons, shrimp seasons, both bay and nearshore Gulf fisheries, and what we did was kind of looked at those recommendations, and the 4 that you see on the screen were the 4 that we heard most consistently across the coast, up and down the coast. So what we are proposing here today is to look just for the spring season, which would begin May 15th, and that would be taking the 2 that we heard that were specific to the spring, to extend the 2 p.m. closure and to increase the daily bag limit for the bay shrimp fishery from 600 pounds per day up to 800 pounds per day. A little information about the fishery. This is the time period, May 15th through July 14th, is the period of time for the spring season. This is the daily bag distribution that's being reported through our commercial trip ticket program to date. And as you'll see, about 73% or so of those landings that are reported today are 200 pounds or less. Less than one half of 1% of the reported landings fishermen are reaching the 600-pound limit that we see today, that's on the record today. The bay shrimp fishery during that same time frame, it's a 200-pound daily bag limit, but you can see that in that same period, May 15th to July 15th, we're seeing about 80% of the landings reported daily of 100 pounds or less. So the proposal that we have before today to go to the Texas Register would be to extend the 2 p.m. closure for the bay and the bay bait and bay fishery. For the bait, that would include April 1st through August the 15th. The bay fishery would May 15th through July 15th. That would, instead of the 2 p.m. closure, it would read they could legally fish from 30 minutes before sunrise to 30 minutes after sunset during that period of time. And then the second one would be to increase that daily bag limit during the bay shrimp season from 600 pounds per day to the 800 pounds per day as proposed. And moving forward, just to follow up and in closing, what we would are proposing to do is to continue our dialogue with the commercial shrimp industry as well as other interested groups that we know have issues and questions about the shrimp fishery, and also to continue evaluation of our data for possible changes to look at in the fall season. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Lance, I guess we all have heard from the shrimpers by now, some way or another. Remind me, and I spoke to Carter a little bit about this, remind me the licensing. I remember during our open meeting in August, I guess it was.
In August,
Some of the shrimpers were complaining about the fact of having to travel during the season to actually acquire a license, if I'm recalling correct. I may not. But how are those licenses sold at this point? Remind me, walk me through the process a little bit of acquiring a license.
Okay. The inshore licenses, they can start by purchasing them by August the 15th.
And that's, what, 2 weeks before that?
The season in the fall starts August the 15th. Okay. And so the reason that we are set up now, that they have to come to a law enforcement office and present documentation, vessel documentation, license so that, and identify themselves, is that those licenses are a commodity. They have value. There's a limited entry on those licenses, and so we are trying to track those licenses very closely to make sure that the vessel and the license match, and we're trying to look at original documents in order to verify that there's a match there, that the individual who is renewing that license is in fact the owner of the vessel.
That makes sense. Now, you mentioned the licenses start at the same time of the season. Is that
for the inshore fishery, the bay inshore fishery? That's correct.
Why is that? I mean, why don't we sell the licenses 2 weeks before, 3 weeks before?
I'm not sure I could answer that.
With the inshore fishery, my name is Brandy Reeder with the Law Enforcement Division. For the record, the inshore fishery comes back to the dock daily. It's not a huge imposition for them to make it to the office. We start selling those licenses, same as we do any of the recreational licenses, 2 weeks before the lapse of their license. So they have 2 weeks in which to conduct their business. For the Gulf licenses, which is what I believe that the individual who had made the complaint about having to come to an office, I believe that was her main, that she was referring to a Gulf license, to where some of those folks will go out for 30 to 45 days and shrimp, and so that's what she was referring to. My understanding, however, is that we sell those licenses as early as, I believe it's May, so they can actually get those licenses well ahead of time.
Okay.
Yes, sir, before the main season really gets kicked off in the Gulf. And as Lance alluded to, the asset value that these limited entry and moratorium licenses have outside of the fee that we charge has ended up with fraud occurring. We actually had a case this past year to where we filed upon an individual who actually split his license. And had we not had the diligence of the face-to-face customer interaction to where our clerk actually caught it, she saw that looked familiar. And so then otherwise that license would have been split. It would have brought another license forward and would have caused issues.
I understand. No, I'm clear on the reasoning. I was just trying to understand the timing, you know,
yes,
that they were not having to stop fishing one of the days during the tort season to come and do the license. So that was my understanding.
But yeah. Randy, let me make sure that I understand this. Now, we've been talking about buying licenses back, and we bought 75% back. When you talk about going to get a license, it's two different things. I guess the license buyback gives you a permit or permission to go buy a license to shrimp for that year, is that correct?
What it is that Coastal Fisheries staff develops an eligibility letter and passes that out to those that are eligible to continue to buy their license. They then take that to our office to then purchase their license. So like in this case that happened this year, is an individual had that eligibility letter. They sold the license to another individual. That person had to wait until he changed the boat over into his name. It was through Coast Guard. It's a lengthy process. And in the interim, before this new owner was able to renew that license in his name, he then bought it or renewed the license that he no longer possessed, therefore effectively splitting the license.
I'm not sure I'm following you. If we're buying back the licenses, are we selling those same licenses again?
No, sir. But
trying to permanently retire the license.
Correct, but the license sales system is not completely bug-proof. They do a very good job, but if something pops up in the license sales system, then it's not necessarily caught.
So again, when we talk about buying a license back, we're talking about buying a permit back to give you the right to go get a purchase a license for that shrimping season.
Right. Yeah, for the record, my name's Robin Rikers. Let me try to help clarify just a little bit here. Brandy is correct, is that when the program started, we basically issued license to anyone who had been previously in the fishery based on a historical perspective. As long as they purchase that license each and every year from the department, which is the time frame we're talking about, they can continue and have that license in perpetuity, basically. Our voluntary buyback program buys those licenses from those individuals and retires them. So basically that license then is removed from the fishery.
Okay. So what licenses are we selling?
We sell to anyone who is eligible a bay or bait, and we also have a moratorium on the Gulf Shrimp license as well. But we basically will sell them any one of those three licenses if they purchased it the year before and we had not retired it.
So you've got to have this threshold license to then buy an annual license?
You have to renew that license every year, yes, sir. You have to have had it in the previous year to renew it into the next year.
Okay, all right. Next question, what's the difference between the bay and the bait?
The bay and the bait are license differences that were in statute many, many years ago, and they've been carried forward in proclamation. The goal there was the bay licenses are structured around a fall and a spring food shrimp season when there's a larger pulse of shrimp coming through. And the bait license itself is really a year-round license that was for the sole purpose of trying to catch and provide bait for recreational anglers.
Okay. What data do we have on the resource itself? I mean, I know that we were shown the slide that shows that landings are down, but what about the situation with the resource over a 10 or 15-year period?
I'm going to let Lance get back up here. I don't mind answering the question, but since he's trying to do this one for us.
Again, for the record, this is Lance Robinson. Looking at our data, fishery independent data, the resource is maintained pretty stable over the years and over the time frame that these licenses have dropped. The resource has maintained stability in that fishery or in the population. What we have seen occur is that bycatch species have increased in numbers throughout the bay, up and down the coast, and there has been some reports from on the Gulf side that the shrimp stocks are more abundant and larger.
So if these proposed changes are made, or is there a concern about even more bycatch?
We don't believe there would be. We're talking 75% reduction in the number of licenses, and there's been a similar reduction in effort. In addition, we in the early 90s or the early 2000s, we've also required bycatch reduction devices to be pulled in bay trawls to help remove finfish species from the nets, and we believe that has also been effective in cutting down on bycatch numbers. And the bycatch species are up, populations are up, but we don't believe the amount of effort in the fishery now, even increasing the time and the bag limit in that spring, is going to have any adverse effect on bycatch species.
Okay. The last question is, what reportings are required by these license holders when they come in? Are there any on a daily basis, monthly, weekly?
Yes, sir. When a trip ends and that fisherman sells his product, shrimp, crabs, whatever it is, to a certified licensed dealer in the state of Texas, the dealer is required to report that trip, that actual day's catch, landings, and the ex-vessel value, what the dealer is paying to that fisherman through our commercial trip tickets program on a daily basis. And so that's reported to Texas Parks and Wildlife. We collect that data, and that's where some of the data you saw on the slide comes from.
So every one of the current license holders has to turn in a daily trip ticket when they go out and secure.
Correct.
In acquiring shrimp and then selling it?
Correct.
And we have those records?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Follow up on that. Is that both bait and the bait and the bay license?
Yes, sir. That's all commercial fisheries, including the bait and the bay.
I want those bait guys come in a bucket to just dump them in there, but I guess they're measuring it and it's
yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Any more questions?
One follow-up. Do you have any data on what you anticipate the effect of this change would be, particularly the 600 pounds a day to 800 pounds a day and the 2 p.m. closure? I mean, we've got the charts that indicate historic catch and numbers, but I just lost it. But do you have something that says, as a result of these rule changes, we think that the percentage will go up whatever percent? Or
well, the graph that you're referring to showing the daily landings, that is current. That was an average over the most recent years, but it includes what they're harvesting as of 2013, I think, is that data, or 2014, that data was valid through. So that's what's happening today. With the proposed increase in bag limit and the extension of the 2 p.m. closure, we believe that there may be some increase in those landings, but we don't believe, based on the amount of vessels in the fishery, we don't believe it's going to be significant. In fact, we have the number of just as an aside, in 2013, we had 378 bait licenses sold statewide, but in that same year, we had 118 that actually reported landings. Bay shrimp, about 380 licensed coastwide, 274 reported actual fishing. At least one day over that calendar year. So we don't believe there's going to be a significant increase in that landings.
Well, and I understand that. I guess all I was asking is there a, typically if you're going to have this kind of a rule change, you have some anticipated impact, and it may be negligible. It may be a small amount. And you may use historical data to come up with that. So, well, if we extend it by a certain percent, we're going to get an increase, a bump, a take of blank percent based on historical data. I mean, I'm just asking, has that analysis been done?
We haven't calculated a percent increase for that time period, and that's something we'll be watching very closely, as Ken alluded to, and when they make their regulations. These are things we track very, very closely to see if the effect is what we anticipate. But we haven't put an actual percentage on what because there's a lot of variables that can affect that harvest. Weather, a lot of things that we have no control over in projecting that percent. We'll look at our fishery independent data, what we actually collect, and see if there's any impact there, and then track the landings from the fishery.
Right. I guess all I'm saying is I would like to, I don't really care what the analysis is. I'm not good enough at math to do it. But I would like to just say we project that the impact will be blank. Mm-hmm. And then you're right. We continue to look at it and we'll analyze it and then see how closely we came to hitting those numbers or exceeding those numbers or whatever.
Okay.
Commissioner, we definitely look at that, and we understand what you're asking for from a modeling perspective. I think, Lance, if I could, maybe one of the mitigating factors here on coastal fisheries and looking at historical records, remember, only half of 1% of those licensees have realized the 600 pounds per day.
Yeah, right.
So it's
right.
A tiny, tiny
negligible
fraction.
Right. It'll probably be negligible.
That's the.
Right.
I think that's a perspective. But let us try to do what we can to do some projections and see if we can bring something forward in the March meeting.
Okay. I'm going to follow up on Mr. Jones. We know what the total bay harvest of shrimp poundage-wise. We have all that data.
We have the landing information.
We have landing data, yes, sir.
What I'm thinking of is what's the impact going to be on our annual take? Because buying the licenses back, and yet the harvest continues to decline. Is that a function of the health of the shrimp fishery, or is that strictly a result of having fewer boats in limited hours?
The drop in landings that you saw in the graph there is certainly a factor associated with reduction in shrimping effort, and that's also tied to reduced reduced number of licenses in the fishery. I mean, there's also environmental factors that play into the biology of the animal. It lives a year, so environmental impacts can affect them in 1 year, and then they'll recover from that very quickly the next year. But yes, it is certainly tied back to the number of boats in the fishery, amount of effort that's being exerted on that fishery as well, and landings.
The shrimp fishery itself has responded, and we think, to the lessening of the pressure of commercial harvest.
We've seen a stable population of shrimp with these reduced numbers. The population of shrimp has remained stable, which is where we'd like to see it. And as I alluded to earlier, bycatch species numbers have increased, which would be expected when you're not harvesting them or collecting them in the course of shrimping activities.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Any more questions? Thank you. If no further discussion, I'll authorize the staff to publish proposed rules in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Work session item number 7, rules governing buoy standards, request permission to publish proposed changes to the Texas standard. Cody, please make your presentation.
Love these chairs. Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Cody Jones. I work for the Law Enforcement Division as a boating law administrator. I'm here to present the proposed changes to regulations governing systems and markings on the public water estate. Currently, the Texas Administrative Code, Section 55.304, references the Uniform State Waterway Buoying Marking System, which historically was contained in Title 33 of the Code of Federal Regulations under Section 62.33. Yeah. In 1998, there was an effort that was underway to move toward one uniform system of markings on public waters. And ultimately, in 2003, the United States Coast Guard replaced the Uniform State Waterway Buoying Marking System with the U.S. AIDS to Navigation System to provide consistency with inland and coastal markers on the water. Under proposed regulation changes, references to the obsolete Uniform State Waterway Buoying Marking System are replaced with current AIDS to Navigation System, and additional references to 33 CFR, Section 62.33, are amended to encompass the entirety of Section 62 as it applies to the public waters of the state. At this time, staff requests permission to publish proposed changes to the buoy standards proclamation and the Texas Register for Public Comment. With that, I have no further information to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Well, basically, all we're doing is making our code uniform with the Coast Guard's code.
Correct, sir. It's just cleanup language to point at the language that's specific to the U.S. Coast Guard.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
No further discussion. I'll authorize staff to propose the rules to the Texas Register for required public comment period. Action item number, or work session item number 8 has been scratched for today, withdrawn. Item number 9, with regard to work session item number 9, land acquisition in Nacogdoches County, 133 acres adjacent to Alazan Bayou Wildlife Management Area. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments? If not, I'll authorize staff to begin the public notice for the input process.
Thank you.
Sorry, Corky. Work session item number 10. Land acquisition in Matagorda County, approximately 267 acres on Matagorda Peninsula. Request permission to begin public notice and input process. Ted, would you please make your presentation?
I think Corky got the long end of that stick. Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This first item I want to bring to your attention regards Matagorda Peninsula in Matagorda County. Matagorda Peninsula is a thin strip of land that separates East Matagorda Bay from the Gulf of Mexico. The peninsula itself is about 22 miles long. East Matagorda Bay has long been a real conservation target for the conservation community in Texas because it is arguably it's the most intact bay system remaining on the upper or mid-coast. It varies in width from 800 feet to a mile. And the east half of the peninsula, and I kind of want to get to that, the east half of that peninsula is actually owned by the General Land Office. At one time, it was Matagorda Peninsula State Park, and legislation in 1995 returned that property to the GLO in exchange for mineral interests under Franklin Mountain State Park. The peninsula is completely undeveloped. Access is difficult.
I'm sorry, you said completely undeveloped?
There are no structures, there are no roads. It's an undeveloped piece of property. Yes, sir. But it has extremely high biological values. Sea turtles nest on those beaches. It's really important stopover habitat for migratory shorebirds, migratory waterfowl, piping plovers, a number of species. I use that in particular, again, because it is so remote and so undeveloped. The portion owned by the GLO, shown in yellow there, is about 11 miles of that frontage on both the Gulf and Matagorda Bay. It is a high enough priority that it's been included in the early restoration proposal for the NRDA trustees for the BP spill settlements. It's also been scoped and presented to the Restore Council as a possible project to offset, again, the impact from the BP oil spill. And it is certainly the hope of the conservation community that at some point that property will come back into public ownership for permanent conservation. A couple months ago, we were contacted by a church in Angleton that had inherited two tracts within the GLO property, and they were interested in selling those. They wanted those sold by the end of the year because the county has tripled the tax valuations for those properties. We were unable to get this in front of the commission in that time frame, and so we've made arrangements. We've worked with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation to make that acquisition. Those two tracts are shown here, 267 acres in interest. Our concern of the conservation community was that if the church sold those into the private sector, then again, at whatever point the rest of that Matagorda Peninsula GLO property is acquired, there would be two more private inholdings that would just create, you know, potentially create management problems. And so the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation is in the process of closing on that acquisition. Staff does recommend that we accept that as a transfer from the foundation to the agency, again, in anticipation of the entire peninsula at some point being in conservation. And with that, staff would request permission to begin the public notice and input process. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Ted, are there any other private inholdings on the peninsula?
Yes, sir. If you look at the map where it's outlined in yellow, you can see there are some gaps in the GLO ownership. There are some tracts in the GLO ownership where the GLO owns 50%, which was the case with one of the church-owned tracts. So there would be some other private interests within that ownership. Yes, sir.
So are we making any efforts to try to acquire those gapped areas? Have we considered that?
We have certainly considered that. We are not actively exploring that at this time for a couple of reasons. One of which is, until this BP oil spill, we hadn't really identified the means of acquiring the peninsula. I think secondly, we wanted to present this to the commission and make the commission aware of this conservation effort before we got out too far ahead of the commission in making contacts and potentially acquiring tracts. But that would certainly be part. At the time we decided to move forward with this and make it an acquisition, again, with the authorization from the commission, we will certainly begin to identify those individuals that have inholdings and try to acquire property that's 100% owned for conservation.
Well, I guess I want to say again how, particularly since Ann Brown's here, how appreciative we are of the efforts of the foundation and Ann and the board once again coming through here on this, and I do think we should move forward, and I don't think it matters whether it's 100% or not. I think we should go ahead and try to acquire as much as a willing seller would turn loose of, as many interests as we can, as because of the way you described the resource in East Matagorda Bay.
Yes, sir, and I have made contact with some of the brokers down there. I think we can very discreetly let it be known that as people approach brokers and say, I have a tract, I'm interested in liquidating, that we're notified of that. I will tell you that my personal biggest concern about the peninsula, I mean, ostensibly it's not very much at risk right now, except that we worked with the GLO to get them to strike the reservation of wind development from any proposal to acquire that through BP settlement tracts. If that were to be developed for wind, it would be a tremendous impact for bird flyover, bird stopover, and even turtle nesting, you know, with the noise that the turbines make and the lights associated with infrastructure and so forth. So, again, the conservation community feels pretty strongly that getting this into permanent conservation would be huge for the resource.
Agree.
All right. Thank you, Ted. If no further discussion, I'll authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. With regards to work session item number 11, acceptance of donation, Bexar County, approximately 22 acres in Government Canyon State Natural Area. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments? If not, I'll place this item on Thursday's commission meeting for public comment and for action. With regards to work session item number 12, land acquisition, Harrison County, approximately 3.4 acres, Caddo Lake State Park. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments? If not, I'll place this item on Thursday's commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Ted, thank you.
Sir.
Final item for this portion of the work session is State Park Public Opinion Survey Update. Kevin Good, please make your presentation.
Morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Kevin Good. I'm with the State Parks Division. I was asked today to give a brief overview of a public opinion poll that was recently completed. I think several of you have a great interest in this, and you may find this information useful in some future conversations. Here we go. The survey was conducted by the Hill Research Consultants out of the Woodlands. This is the fifth iteration of this public opinion poll. The first one was done back in 1999. The survey was commissioned by the Parks and Wildlife Foundation with some support from the Hershey Foundation, the Knobloch Family Foundation, and other interested individuals, including some of our State Park Advisory Committee supporters. So a little bit about the survey. It's going to be released to the public today. It was a random sample of 600 active voters. The interviews were conducted on December 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of this past year, and it's estimated there was a margin of error of about plus or minus 4%. The results of the poll are not really surprising. They generally conform with previous polls that have been done. But a couple of the key findings I wanted to go over. First of all, 92% of the respondents saw parks as being especially important to families in tough economic times. 88% of the folks see parks as essential to a healthy lifestyle for Texans. And 84% of the respondents expressed support for the need to protect natural areas for the future. I'm going to go into a couple of those a little bit more deeply. First of all, the concept that parks are valued for family recreation. When asked specifically,
Do you agree with the statement, public parks are especially important to families needing an affordable recreational outlet? 92% of the respondents agreed. That support was pretty consistent across the state. Perhaps surprisingly, the highest support for that concept was in the High Plains and the West Texas area, where 92% of the people agreed with that statement. It was consistent across party lines. And even 83% of the folks that said that they never engage in outdoor recreation agreed with that statement. When asked if they agreed with the statement, unless we protect Texas's natural areas, we will lose the very things that make Texas a special place in which to live, 84% of the people agreed. Again, the support was high across the state. 4 out of 5 of the respondents identified themselves as Republicans and identified with that or agreed with that statement. And 82% of those, again, that said, we don't ever recreate, agreed with that statement. The attitudes expressed in this opinion poll have not changed a lot over the years. As I mentioned, the first time this poll was conducted was in 1999. And the findings of the poll have not really changed a lot over the years. It's been very consistent, as you can see by this graph. As the poll went on, it asked specifically about the sporting goods sales tax. And pollsters explained the basic concepts of the sporting goods sales tax to the people. And ask, do you approve or disapprove of acquiring, maintaining, and operating state and local parks with revenue from the funding mechanism known as the sporting goods sales tax? The largest percentage of folks, 43%, said that they approved of that strongly. Only 18% disapproved of that statement. So less than 1 in 5 of our voters disagreed with that concept. When asked specifically if an election were held on the matter, would you vote yes to approve a constitutional amendment to dedicate that sporting goods sales tax for parks and prohibit the use for other purposes, 70% said that they would approve. Only 26% said that they would reject that concept. Over two-thirds of the people approved of that amendment, regardless of party affiliation. And 83% of those that said that they didn't recreate in the outdoors said that they would approve of that. Excuse me, 63%. So the takeaway messages from this poll. First of all, conservation is a core value of Texans. The fact that the support has been consistent over time and has maintained a stable level of support shows that this is not some flash in the pan public opinion that might rise and fall over time. It's also supported all across the state, people in all areas and all socioeconomic backgrounds. Voters have continued to be supportive of parks and conservation. In fact, the folks that said that they were strong supporters of a constitutional amendment actually ticked up a little bit in the last couple of years. And we have seen continued support for this, again, since the beginning of this polling was done in 2009. This poll is going to be released, I believe, today by the Parks and Wildlife Foundation and will be available to the public in the future. And that is we'll close my presentation and I'll answer any questions if you have any
questions. Rob, Kevin, you said that the poll results were that 8% of those who responded did not agree parks were important to family recreation.
Yes, sir.
Why?
You know, I could only speculate on that. Perhaps they're just generally curmudgeons, or perhaps that they never go outside.
Well, the poll didn't ask why.
They did not, not in the information that I have, but I don't believe they ask follow-up questions on that, no.
Okay, and then the answer may be the same on the, I think you said the poll reflected that 18% of the respondents disapproved of the sporting goods sales tax, and 26% would reject it as a constitutional amendment. Again, I suppose we don't know why those people purportedly felt that way.
That's correct. I could speculate that there's some folks that would just oppose any type of constitutional change on a philosophical basis or something of that nature.
Okay. Any more questions? I just want to say, comment that I think this poll reconfirms what we've known, that parks are very important to the people of the state of Texas, the voters, and it's very important to this commission that we find a more permanent and consistent way to fund state parks. And you know, we're growing our park system. We have just 95 parks right now. We have more coming online, and it's just very important that we come up with a mechanism to fund them, and this commission is going to work very hard on that. And I thank you for your presentation. That's good news.
Thank you.
That's pretty fast this morning. Work session item number 14, Cross Timbers Wildlife Management Area Land Acquisition Strategy. This could be heard in executive session. So at this time, I'd like to announce that pursuant to the requirement of Chapter 555 Government Code referred to the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of seeking legal advice under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act and deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Open Meetings Act. We will now recess for executive session. Thank you. We now will reconvene the regular session of the work session, January 21st, 2015, at 12:05 p.m. With regard to work session item number 14, Cross Timbers Wildlife Management Area Land Acquisition Strategy, I authorize the staff to begin public notice and input process. And with that, we've completed our work session business. Adjourn.